we've been in a hold the line sort of a phase nationally, I think. And the last few years in particular, things have really started to snowball, and we're now starting to bring the Māori back to the forest. The life force is coming back, and the diversity is coming back. So there is no doubt in my mind that 10 to 20 years from now, if we keep this momentum and we keep learning, we keep adding new tools, and we keep that investment of time and money, that we're actually going to start to turn the tide back, not just hold the line. That's pretty neat. The true heroes in this space, in my opinion, are those foot soldiers that go out day after day in any weather in hard country and do that hard mahi. And we have so many amazing people like that, and we need to celebrate them, because if you remove enough of the bad stuff, the good stuff will take care of itself.
Hello, kia ora.
And welcome to the People Helping Nature podcast.
We're your hosts. I'm Callum.
And I'm Anna. And today we're joined by John Bissell from Backblocks Environmental Management Limited. Kia ora, John. Welcome to the show.
Kia ora.
It's such a pleasure to have you here. Would you like to start by introducing yourself and how you got into predator control?
Yeah, no problem. Well, I mean, I'm the owner, operator, slash director for a little company called Backblocks Environmental Management Limited. And I am based in the Wairarapa, but I travel around the country working with groups. I'm also the National Predator Control Advisor for an organisation called Save the Kiwi. And it's an absolute privilege to work alongside so many good people in the conservation space, both on the ground, but also around the strategy and delivery side of things as well. As far as my conservation story is concerned, I can't really remember a time when I wasn't obsessed by wild places and nature. And it's been in my DNA for as long as I can remember. I was noticeable at home by my absence, any free moment I had, and I used to come in when I was hungry, and my parents were very forgiving in that space. So my career path has been as a professional hunter. I've got a science degree, and I, for a large part of my career, was a career ranger. So lots of different hats I've worn over the years, but it's all come back to conservation of our Tonga species. And that kind of came to a head for me in 2016 when I left paid employment and set up Backblocks. And it's been a whirlwind ever since. Having a lot of fun.
Thank you, John, and welcome again. Speaking of hunting, you often refer to yourself as a predator hunter as well. For those of our listeners who are not too familiar with predators, or often called predator pests, what are they and why are they such a big problem for New Zealand ecosystems?
Predators in this country are different to predators in a lot of other countries. In New Zealand, the native species that we have here developed and evolved without mammalian predators. They still had predators, but most of them were avian, etc. And a lot of the species that we have in this country, their morphology and the way they breed and their lifespans, etc., developed with what I would call a lower rate of predation. So kiwi is a really good example. They're a flightless bird that's basically ground dwelling. They're very slow breeders and reasonably slow to mature. So they developed in an environment where they didn't have to worry as much about external predation pressure by upline predators. So when people arrived in this country, they brought with them a raft of mammalian predators that were significantly worse than what many of our native species were used to, and they had a catastrophic effect on our Tonga species. Predators can be anything from mice through to feral cats, and include rats, stoats, ferrets, weasels, possums, all of those sorts of species. And often these were predators that, when they were introduced into this country, they found an open pantry that was well stocked, and they bred very rapidly and then had an even greater impact on our species. So in this country, that's one of our biggest challenges, is that our species haven't evolved with coping mechanisms for those types of predators.
Yeah, right. I think it can be quite a shock for some people realizing that introduced mammalian predators such a major problem in our conservation space, to the point where in many ways one of the main challenges of conservation in New Zealand is controlling the introduced species so that our native species can thrive. So what are the main measures that we use to control mammalian predators in New Zealand? How do we look after them, or how do we keep them at bay?
Look, I think it's really important for people to understand that what's been happening, particularly over the last 100 to 150 years, has been a steady state of depletion of our native species. And what that means is that each successive generation of people in this country used to encountering less and less of our native species. And what was normal 50 years ago or 100 years ago is very different to what's normal now. And so people, in many cases, don't appreciate what we've lost because they've never experienced it any other way. And one of the greatest things with the whole predator-free movement and the change in that tide and the great conservation work that's being done by so many people and projects is that we're starting to re-experience what things used to be like, and we're almost turning back the clock. And what that means is it's demonstrating and showing people that might not otherwise have known what we've lost. And it's invigorating and reinvigorating communities to dig even deeper and go further. So one of my sayings, I've got lots of little sayings, anybody that knows me has heard them, but one of my sayings is if we remove or kill enough of the bad stuff, the good stuff will be able to take care of itself. And that's very, very true with predator control, but we need to remove enough predators to enable that to happen. When you talk about tools, most of the tools that we've been using in this country up until now have been what I would term to be manual tools, traps, poisons, and shooting, essentially, most of them. And they have been refined and honed and adapted over the years to suit our situations. And we are in a constant state of evolution when it comes to those control methods as well. There's a lot of technology that is now coming to the surface. There's been a huge push, particularly in the last 5 to 10 years, to develop and design better control options that are well suited to rugged and remote landscapes. And by that, I'm talking about resetting traps, AI traps, which enable facial recognition so that there's a far higher degree of accessibility into that trap while still maintaining a high degree of safety for non-target species. So there's some amazing stuff that's happening, and I expect that in 5 to 10 years from now, we will be blown away by what we have in the way of tools. Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that. And it's definitely an ever-expanding toolkit of resources, isn't it?
It's so exciting.
Because it's such a core part of what we do here in New Zealand. And you said that we're slowly but surely changing the tides and returning to a better normal, or restoring the balance a little bit more. What would happen if we were to stop predator control in New Zealand?
Well, that's a really good question. And the unfortunate answer to that is that the clock would quickly reset and we would end up in a ever downward spiraling situation of depletion. The reality of this type of mahi is that there's no point starting it unless you're going to continue, because many of our introduced predator species are rapid breeders with large litters and they're very quick to mature. So they can reset that clock very, very quickly if we take our foot off the throttle. Another point that I'd like to note, though, with all of this conversation is that we've gone very new school in our approach. And anyone that knows me and knows the messages that I preach strongly that we need to bring back and retain some of the old world skills when it comes to predator control. And by that I mean we need to relearn some of the lost arts in trapping and bushcraft. And we need to use those to enable us to better use the new technology that's being given to us now. Technology is wonderful, but it's not just what you use, it's how you use it. And a good predator hunter will add huge value to whatever tool they use in this space.
Yeah, one of the things I've heard you say a number of times is that predators don't really want to die. They don't want to walk into your trap and be killed, and you need to think like a predator to catch them. I see this in quite a lot of trapping I stumble across, where groups, maybe there's grass growing over the entrance to the trap, maybe they haven't shaved off the filings, and so, you know, so the skin doesn't get scratched as the stoat enters the trap, etc. Do you think that often comes down to education or down to just not willingness to take action properly?
It's a really good point. I think another one of my sayings is that, you know, 50% of good trapping is knowledge, and the other 50% is care and attention. And I always prefer to take somebody with a great attitude and then train them. You can't train an attitude. And one of the great things about so much of our community trapping is the people out there doing it have an amazing attitude. So what we need to focus on 9 times out of 10 is, as you say, building that knowledge and training and mentoring and teaching people so that they can then take the ball and run with it. And I've seen in the last 4 to 5 years in particular a huge surge and upswing in the quality of delivery being done out there. We've still got some work to do in that space, but there's no doubt in my mind that people are understanding at a far greater rate the difference that quality can make. And that's so encouraging to see. I'm so pleased to see that. And it really is. And you're 100% right. You know, I mean, another one of my little sayings, you know, we're often too busy treating these animals like they're stupid and they want to die. And there did at one point seem to be this childlike belief that if we put any sort of trap out there and set it anyway and plonk it in the ground, that sooner or later these animals are going to find it and they'll be lined up waiting to go in. And in actual fact, it's completely the opposite. And I do a lot of time with trail cameras in particular set to video because, you know, and for me personally, I mean, I'm not a trapper. I'm a predator hunter, but I'm more than a predator hunter. I'm an animal behaviorist. And the best predator hunters I know are people that are insanely curious about every aspect of what they do. And it's also coupled with that, they're extremely fussy. And the way to learn how you can do things better is by watching these animals interact with your control mechanisms and look at their body language and listen to the messages that they're sending to you so that you can adjust what you do. The other thing I'd also like to touch on is the conversation around respect. And, you know, I've been introduced by clients to people as this is Johnny, he's our hired killer. And I get called a killer quite a bit. And you know what, that's okay. There's so many of us out there, we're frontline foot soldiers in a war that we're fighting really hard. But it's so important to have huge respect for these predators and these animals and these what we call as pests. And I struggle with the term pest in many ways, because to me that sends a message that these animals have no value, whereas in their home turf they are part of a very important ecosystem, and they didn't ask to be here, and it's our job to remove them, but in doing so we shouldn't lose respect for them. And I think the moment that you lose respect for these animals, you actually also stop learning about them too. So for me as a hunter, respect is at the heart of everything I do in this space and around these animals. And that might sound a bit strange to some people, but you know, being humane, being kind, being respectful, but also winning is okay.
Mm. Mm. Thank you for saying that.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought up the respect thing so early in the conversation, because it's something that I personally sometimes fear we're losing the more mainstream predator control gets, especially with Predator Free 2050. And I think we need to look at us very, very closely so we keep that up and foremost, that we acknowledge that we are dealing with incredibly smart creatures.
And oh, they're beautiful. Give them,
yeah, that credit, yeah, alongside doing the saving to kill strategy, really.
If you ask any hunter why they hunt and how can they shoot something that they value so highly, they won't be able to answer that question. It's not a question that you can answer, and I can't answer it. I don't do this job because I love killing. I do it because I love life, and I love the life in the mountains and the forests around me. And it sounds very flowery to talk like that, but for people that may not move in these circles or live in this world, there's a lot of urbanized people now, they'll struggle to understand the circle of life and the fact that it is a life and death conversation, and that's nature. We are far more emotional than nature is. Nature doesn't apply emotion to anything. Nature just does what it does, and it's a conundrum. Hmm.
So I just want to take it to a certain extreme here. I've heard this term compassionate conservation bandied around from time to time, and some people I have heard saying we can save our native birds and our native plant ecosystems without removing these animals, and that we shouldn't kill them because it's not fair to kill them, even though they might maybe introduced. And I disagree with that. You know, I think if you have any connection to the ecosystem and you know what impact they have, it is a matter of our native birds or the mammalian species, and same with browsing ungulates or our understory and our canopies of our forest. But do you have any thoughts on how to address that? Like, for people that haven't fully grasped the importance of removing these introduced mammals?
Yeah, I mean, it is an interesting one. I mean, only in people's minds does there exist a world where nothing dies. The fact of the matter is, in life and in nature, for something to live, something must die. And that's the reality of it. And it's called the circle of life and all sorts of things, but it's the truth. I think it is an increasing issue. And what we're seeing now in an increasingly urbanized society is that people are increasingly disconnected from the natural world. And it is a real challenge. For those of us in conservation, we are now being influenced and judged by others who don't have the practical experience of nature and the natural world that those of us that live and work in it do. And it's not to say they're wrong, but the reality is that life will go on and do what it does, and nature will as well. And so for me personally, I just see myself as a part of nature. And if we want to have biodiversity, which is a lovely big word, but in this country, if we want to retain and protect our Tonga species that are part of our national identity, that's essentially what it is, then stuff has to die for that to happen. Mm. It would be a wonderful world if we didn't have to control predators and if they could all exist side by side, but the last 200 years have shown us that that is not the case. And the only thing that survives in this situation is something that can breed and defend itself. And we don't have many of those native species like that in this country. We will have but a remnant, if any at all, if we don't do something about it. And all we're doing at the moment really is holding the line.
Mm. Yeah, I for those of our listeners who don't know, I do the odd educational tour here and there. And I always explain it similar to you, saying that humans came into this country and significantly untipped the balance by introducing those predators. So now it's our job to restore it. And unfortunately, and I fully agree with you, it would be lovely and wonderful to not kill anything in this country. But I feel like if we want to restore what we naturally have, there's no way around it. And our job is just doing it respectfully. Yeah. And there's a lot of community groups in New Zealand, and you've also already mentioned them, who are doing so often in their own time and doing an amazing job as well. And speaking of that quality, what's your main advice that you often give to those groups when they first kick off and want to tackle this big job in their local area?
The people in community groups that do that sort of work are the real heroes in this space, in my opinion.
Yep.
They're amazing. Yep. And it's a privilege for me to be able to work with them. And you know what? I go and spend time with these people and they go, thank you so much for coming and helping us and blah, blah, blah. But I say, actually, the honour's all mine. These are amazing people. And I'm in awe of the effort and the dedication around this country shown by those groups and those people. But the first thing for groups to think about is, what does success look like to you? Before you start, you need to decide what it is you're trying to achieve. And there's no wrong answer in that space, but it's really important to have goals. And then from your goals will come your strategy. And from your strategy will come your plan on how you will deliver that. And so the first thing I always ask of groups is, what does success look like to you? What do you want to achieve? And it might be that they want to see more tui in the trees in their neighbourhood. They want to bring kōkako back. They want to reintroduce kiwi or whio or something like that. Or it might simply be that they're lonely and they want to meet a bunch of like-minded people and get exercise and have social connection. Great, great reason. So everyone has a different why, but you must figure out what your why is before you can figure out what your what and your how is. Yeah.
Yeah, so other than that, once they figure out their why, they figure out why they're doing and what the plan's going to look like, what would your top three tips be for, as far as trapping goes, to improve the results that a group will get?
The top tip actually is, get good advice. You will save or lose the most amount of money and effort at the start of a project through deciding what you do than at any other time. And that's the best, most important thing. Get good advice. And when I say good advice, get good advice from somebody who actually knows what they're talking about and who has done it. And the paint-by-numbers routine is okay to a point, but somebody who will ground truth your project or what you're proposing or wanting to do and give you that real fine-edge advice can mean the difference of thousands and thousands of dollars and thousands of hours per year. And sometimes you can achieve far more with far less too. And so advice and having someone to walk alongside you in that space is so important. And they must be somebody who has learned through doing, not just regurgitating a recipe, to put it bluntly. And so those people exist in this country. Get them on your team and hang on to them. And it makes such a difference. So advice is really important. From that advice will stem good design. And by good design, I mean, what type of trap are you going to use? Where is the best place to put that trap? what's the best regime you can do to operate that trap, how often, what you bait it with, etc., etc. And all of those little things will flow on from that. So you know, vision, advice, strategy, design. Yep.
Mm.
And one of the big things for me sometimes when I start working with a group, I'm working more and more with farmers now in catchment groups, and they're fantastic people. They're so motivated. They're no fuss. They just want to get on with it. But one of the things I say to these groups is be okay with doing less to start with. You are better off starting small and doing it well and then growing capability as you grow capacity, rather than trying to do too much too soon and falling flat on your face. And one of the greatest strengths of our community conservation people is their passion and their commitment. One of the greatest weaknesses of our community conservation people is their passion and their commitment, because they don't want to settle for second best. They don't want to do any less. They want to go out there and change the world, and they want to do it within 6 to 12 months. They want kōkako here next year. Thank you very much. And the reality is that nature doesn't work like that. And we need to be a little bit kind to ourselves too. And sometimes I go to these groups and they're feeling a bit broken and beaten up because they're feeling like they're being ineffective. And you've got to remind them what they've achieved and celebrate that success. And it's such an important part of what we do. And, you know, it's, So, but those are the big ones that I would suggest. Really important.
Don't overshoot it, right? Yeah, I mean, I think it's easy to forget that conservation outcomes are decades and generations, not months and years.
100%.
And I'd rather see an organization do a smaller amount of stuff, right, but resource that for 20 years instead of a 3 or 5 year cycle on a massive amount
Absolutely.
Of work.
Yeah. Which comes right back to what we talked about right at the beginning. There is no point starting something unless you're going to continue. So you Absolutely. Are better off doing less sustainably than a flash in the pan and walk away.
So Let's say we are getting our trap lines ready to roll out. We're putting our predator control in place. And I'm thinking maybe I see some traps for sale, or I went to a project down the road and they had this specific type of trap. Is a trap a trap a trap? Like, can we just put any traps into any environment and hope that they work? Or is there a lot of nuance when it comes to methodology for rollout? And would you say that's going to change a lot around the country and around different ecosystems and situations? Or does that tie into the whole advice thing?
Anna's smiling because she knows what I think about this. Bottom line is that traps are not all created equal. A trap is not a trap. That's a really good question, Callum. I've another little saying, but I call it trapability. And there are so many trap types out there, and not all of them have been designed with the animal in mind. Some of them have been designed to catch people in wallets and checkboxes more than they have animals.
Quite effectively.
Yeah, and that's right. And you know, some have been designed by engineers, which are great, but you still need to have an animal behaviorist on your team, because ultimately the success of a trap comes down to animal behavior. So the trapability of a trap is really important to consider. The cost of that trap is important to consider. The shelf life in the environment of that trap is really important to consider. The safety of that trap around non-target species where you're going to use it is so important to consider. And I'm not just talking about other native species. It could be small children's hands or pets in an urban environment. So there's so many aspects of a trap that needs to be considered when you decide on what you're going to use. And once again, it comes back down to that advice. And what I say to clients of mine is that you should treat me like a filter or a funnel. And this is how much I'm considering. This is what you get, because I don't need to bog you down with all of that. You just need to know what you need to know. Mm-hmm. And that good advice can really help simplify and streamline and uncomplicate things as well. But, yeah, they are not all created equal. and one size does not fit all, for sure.
Mm.
You got me on my soapbox on that one.
No, and I feel like it gets more and more confusing by the hour, because there's more and more getting put on the market, and I definitely feel this helplessness around sometimes, where people just don't even know anymore what they need for their particular area. And then also sometimes people are totally lost knowing which trap to get in the first place for which animal they're trying to trap.
I've got an idea I just came up with. So we have like bird of the year and bug of the year and these things. What if we had trap of the year and you could vote for your favorite trap as a way to educate people?
I think that's a great idea. Yeah, that's a great idea. Look, there's some fantastic traps out there. I gave a talk at a national kiwihui a few years ago, and I called it Chasing the Silver Bullet Dream. And what that was is that we're all sort of pinning our hopes on new technology, whereas in actual fact, we've got some great tools at our hand now. If we use the right ones and we use them really, really well, we've got some great options. And you can give 10 trappers the same trap and they'll get 10 different results, because it's the predator hunter and the trapper operating them that still makes a huge amount of difference. And some of the older school traps are still really, really good. The bottom line is, with any sort of trap, the more steps an animal has to go through to get caught, the less you will catch with that trap. The more unnatural it is, the harder it is to enter. If you're asking them to stick their heads into a blind corner or a dark alley, you'll catch less with it. So there's lots of things to consider. One of my favourite things I like to do, or I'm a tutor for Bay Conservation for their Conservation Cadets course, and we've got a big whiteboard, and one of the little quotes that I wrote at the top of the whiteboard at the start of each course, there's only one question you ever need to ask yourself when you're thinking about what you're going to use and how you're going to use it. And that question is, how will they feel about it? And if you can, as a predator hunter and a trapper, can answer that question, you will make good decisions on the hill and you will make good decisions in your design. Because what we've tended to do in this country is take the animal out of the center of the wheel when we're making our decisions. And in actual fact, and what we tend to do is decide on our control methods sometimes and then expect the animal to work around us or the species or the population. Mm. It should be the other way around. We should be working around them with everything we do when it comes to hunting these animals. And one of the other things I say is that really in this space as predator hunters, we're salespeople. It's our job to sell them the dream. And often in a sale, in a successful sale, it's a 5 or 6 step process. And if you're going to be a successful predator hunter, it's not just what trap you use. It's thinking about every part of the journey that animal goes through, from walking down there to interacting with your trap to going into your trap. And you've kind of got to think of every step of that process for that animal and answer all the questions for them, so that when they're there and you're not there anymore, that process plays out. So be salespeople is a big thing that I say to my community groups.
And I think that is so important, right? Because they, like you already said, they are actually incredibly smart, and we have to acknowledge so that and then try to trick them into doing what actually we need them to do.
That's what makes it fun. Sorry, I mean, we've got to I'd get bored if I was doing the same stuff all the time. You know, if it's not a challenge, it stops being interesting for me anyway. And so we've got to be able to rise to that challenge and be able to take on any number of variables and be able to still be successful and win. And often what I find myself talking about more and more with predator hunters and trappers is that whole mindset. The mindset of a successful predator hunter. And it's all about your attitude and your approach to this stuff. And you know what? We should model ourselves on elite sports people, because when we're out there on the hill, something's life depends on whether or not we're successful. So our job is to win. And that's okay. It's okay to be a winner in this space, and we should celebrate that.
So, ensuring that we're winning, how do we actually measure our success? How do I know that the network I set up to save those species that are native and endemic to New Zealand, how do I know that I'm doing enough and that what I'm actually doing is working for me in my area?
Oh, great question. Yeah. And I mean, another little saying, I say trap and test and know, don't trap and hope. And we need to get rid of that whole trap and hope mentality, because you need to know exactly, as you said, if what you're doing is giving you the results that you want. And ultimately, that's monitoring. And it's not what we catch that counts. It's what we leave behind that counts. That's the key. And too often, I think, still, we are celebrating too much the animals that we've caught and not measuring what's remaining. And so monitoring is a huge part of what I do. To come back to what we were talking about with community groups when they're starting a project up, it's a really important thing to do, is to take the temperature of what you're doing then and there. And that's that baseline monitor and understanding what pest species or predator species you've got in your whenua and how many there are as well, and then be able to monitor to that. So there's two key sorts of monitors, really. There's result monitoring, and that's the abundance of your target species. So you do a pre-control monitor and then a post-control monitor, or a monitor as you go. So you can measure how many you've removed or how many are left. So you're measuring the living. The other one is an outcome monitor, which is the response of the taonga species that you're trying to grow and protect, and how they're responding to what you're doing. And I mean, kiwi are a really good example of that. And kiwi and pheo is another one. So every predator species and prey species has a different number that they will be okay with. And by that I mean stoats, for example. You can have a higher number of stoats remaining and still get successful recruitment of a pheo population compared to a kiwi population. So if you want to grow kiwi at place successfully, you need to remove far more stoats than, say, a pheo population at times. And so really important stuff to know. So you almost need to monitor both to understand if you're getting the results that you desire.
Sorry, I have a side question about that, which I'd love to know your insight on. If we're going to measure the results of our predator control and the biodiversity success, and we want to put financial incentive behind that, in the business space, there's biodiversity credits coming out, which are starting to become regulated in the coming years. But in general, for all funding, should we be looking at the effects and the success of our work based on the outcomes of the species or the results, or should we have a hybrid blend to judge the success of our work? Or because I'm just worried about people getting too caught up on one metric that doesn't paint the whole picture, and then letting that one snapshot of reality determine their whole entire view. Yeah, how can we make sure that our measurement of success is resilient?
I think for me personally, it ultimately does come down to your outcome monitoring, the response of your protected species. Because that's ultimately our end game. That's what we're trying to do. We're not just killing stuff for killing's sake. Ultimately, we're doing it with a purpose and for a reason, and that purpose and reason is to grow our threatened species. So if we're being successful in growing our threatened species populations and increasing biodiversity, then I would suggest that our pest control regime is proving itself as successful. And as I said, every different species needs a different regime to help it to grow. The other thing is that predator numbers will be different in different landscapes and different areas. And if you gauge the success of an operation on how many stoats they caught, then you might find one area looks really successful, but it's successful because there's more stoats here to start with. But if you gauge the response of your protected species, that to me is the ultimate end game. That's what we're in it for. So biodiversity, growing biodiversity, then you talk about what you need to do that. And it will be different site by site. It's so important to remember that you can't just have a one-size-fits-all predator control regime. It needs to be customized. It needs to take so many different localized factors into consideration to make sure it can be the best it can be.
And I guess it's also understanding, right, that variation is key, so they don't get bored of or too accustomed of X, Y, Z that you've been doing for the last 20 odd years.
100%. I call it moving the goalposts. And almost never do I remove enough of one predator species with one control method and luring regime alone. That's the reality. It's so often so important to vary what you do and change it up.
Coming back to quality and intelligence, say I'm Sally the Stoat and I live in a forest and there's a great trapping network around, but I had a real close call with one of your traps and I just managed to escape because it wasn't calibrated right. So will I ever go near one of your traps again? Like, can I remember that incident and what happens next?
What we're talking about here is trap shy or trap averse animals. And when you have that conversation in the halls of power anywhere in the country in conservation, you will find a wide range of opinions as to whether or not it even exists or it's such a thing. For me personally, I'm absolutely convinced of it. And I'm convinced of it because of what I've seen out there doing what I do. I do a huge amount of work with trail cameras to watch what's happening around my trap sets. And I have simulated, a really good example is dock traps with the boxes with the mesh. And usually the way they used to come from the factory, they've improved a lot, but they used to be really bad. They'd be snipped entrances with jaggedy bits all around the edge, like they were guarding the entrance to a castle. And a stoat could get snagged on that and have a really bad experience. And what I can tell you is I've simulated that with a trail camera set on video, and I've watched stoats partially enter dock traps, get snagged obviously on the sprags at the entrance, and pull out and rapidly depart the scene. Almost 100% of the time, I never see what I'm pretty convinced is that stoat back at that trap site. I'm sure of it. I have watched on video cage trap sets with Jill or female feral cats in very remote country beating their kittens away from a trap set and physically beating them up at the trap set to give them a bad experience. So when you see that, you realize that I think sometimes these predators are evolving faster than our thinking. For me, once again, another little saying, but if we target the smart ones, the dumb ones come easy. And I think we underestimate these animals at our peril. And my answer to all of that is that what do I have to lose by treating these animals as though they're the incredibly smart, savvy, cautious and beautiful animals they are, instead of just treating them like they're stupid and they want to die? If I trap as though they're all super, super wary, then I stand to be more successful, I think, than if I just slap stuff down and don't worry about it.
Yeah, I think this is a blind side of the predator control sector in general. Like you said earlier, there's a lot of good intention that can lead to early traps performed poorly, which creates a trap shy population of animals, which is a major unspoken or under discussed issue. Is there any way of measuring how many trap shy animals are in an area, or of quantifying the scale of the problem on the ground?
Yeah, just quickly to stay on that topic, I think the key here is that we need to get away from that quantity mindset and move into a quality mindset. Too often still, nationally, we're asked to report on hectares under control. Now, my question is always, are they good hectares? And I always say that I would much rather have 20 good traps than 200 poor or average traps. Because as I've said, it's not what we remove that counts, it's what we leave behind. But it's not just about what we remove or don't remove, it's do we educate them in the meantime as well. And so what I tend to see when I move into an area that's been untrapped is you get a huge spike in catches, for example, with stoats, and then it drops off dramatically. The question then is, did you catch them all, or did you just catch the ones you were going to get with that method? So there's some real, I think there's some challenges, and I think we need to rethink and reprioritize some of the thinking that we're doing in this space. And I'm seeing a shift towards that now in a really pleasing way. So, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, that's fascinating. So how will we measure what trap shy animals are left?
I don't think you can. Because we can't have a conversation with them and say...
And you don't know if it's on the trap
or whatever. All we can do is measure what's remaining. And if you are measuring... I mean, I've developed my own methodology for trail camera monitoring. And if you have a return, for example, trail cameras are really sensitive. But if you have a 50% return rate on your cameras with stoats in that area that you're monitoring, but you're not catching any stoats and it's a good regime, I would suggest you could make an assumption with a degree of security or safety that you have trap-averse animals in that population. If you're seeing them but you're not catching them, why not? And if you know you're trapping well and your quality is up to scratch, your density and your regime is everything that you know it should be, but you're not catching them, there's a bit of an answer there or a red flag for sure. Yep. Mm. Can we quantify that? I don't think so.
And I guess all you see on your camera is a stoat, right? And you never quite know if that's the same or if that's... Who is that stoat and how often have I seen it, right? That's very hard without marking them.
Different species, it's not so bad. Possums are not too bad. Feral cats are easy. Ferrets aren't too bad at times too. Stoats are tricky, but if it's a large male stoat or a female stoat or a juvenile stoat, you can tell between those. Yeah, they're probably one of the tougher animals to identify individuals in a population for sure.
So how can a group solve this problem? For example, if we have kiwi and need to really suppress our stoat populations, what are our next steps?
If you can answer that question, you will be given an OBE, because that's a question that's being asked a lot in conservation in New Zealand right now. The reality is that in a lot of our landscape scale projects, toxin use is forming part of that answer, and it's still a relatively controversial topic at times, but the reality is that a pulse of 1080, for example, it turns every rat and mouse into a mobile bait station for stoats over a large area of land over a very short space of time. Stoats are very high octane animals that need to eat constantly to survive. So they will generally target a dead or dying rodent because they physically have to eat. But it's also very natural to them to be able to predate something like that, which then kills those stoats. So what a pulse of toxin like that can do at times is reset the clock with those animals that may not enter your trapping regime. And you go back to a naive population as animals move back into your control zone. So it can have a huge and long-lasting impact in the success of your stoat control regime. What the trapping often then does is prolong the gains made through that toxin application. The biggest challenge I'm seeing, I'm a hunter, I'm a trapper, and I love that aspect of what I do. And one of the biggest challenges I'm seeing is some of the more urban type kiwi conservation projects where toxin use isn't an option due to a number of reasons, And so they're basically being forced to rely on trapping, and they're struggling to catch enough stoats to make a difference long term with a kill trapping regime. And so one of the things I do with those groups is we look at other options of manually removing those more cautious stoats. Yeah.
Mm, yeah, I think it's like we've got a certain toolkit now. There's the use of toxins, and 1080 in particular brings up some pretty strong emotions with people.
Yeah.
But I think it's important to acknowledge, this is the toolkit we've got right now. And I guess our approach to control is going to change as we evolve and new tech comes out. But zooming out a bit, assuming we do this right, what are the positive knock-on effects of good quality predator control?
That's the key. The first most important thing is to have that quality there, so you're not training your animals or your target predators to avoid your control regime. If you start with really high quality and do it right from the beginning, the tail on those gains you make will be far longer. If you do it badly, you're educating them very, very quickly. It's not just about what you're catching, it's what you leave behind, as we've said. So I was on an island three or four years ago where they had a stoat, and I said, what about that island over there, quite close to where we were talking about? They said, oh, so-and-so's, that's being trapped. I said, yes, but is it being trapped well? And we need to get away from that assumption that any trapping is good trapping. And in actual fact, sometimes bad trapping is worse than no trapping, because not only are you not removing enough animals to make a difference, you're educating them at why you're doing that. And so quality is really, it should be front and center for everything that we do. Yeah.
Mm, definitely.
It's a bit like a marathon runner. If that, before they run a marathon, if they just went for a walk around the block every third night as preparation to run a marathon, they'd fail. You know, if you want to be successful, you need to put the work in. And that's why I say you're better off putting work into a smaller area sometimes, but doing it really, really well. And if you grow capability, then you can increase.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, I've got to take my hat off to you, Anna, early in my trapping days, teaching me that was, I would go out and I just kind of scuff the sides of the trap and, you know, do the best practice I've been taught and think, this is good. I'm probably doing more than the average trapper, but I'm happy with it. Then you would come along and you would scuff a long line. You would move the trapper meter over to the side, put logs alongside it,
then get
the bait, rub it up against it, drop some blood. And I'd be like, wow, okay. And I think
beautiful. The result
performed well. Yeah.
Yeah. After that.
And you taught your dad, John, so thank you.
I'm having a proud dad moment. But it's so true. And, you know, I've seen it done so many times by really good trappers. They'll go into an area that's been traditionally trapped and they'll add their magic to that trap regime and be 5, 6, 10 times more successful. You know, the difference a good quality operator makes is just, it's an absolute skill. And one of the things that we need to do, and I say this quite often, is we need to make predator hunting sexy. And I'm the wrong person for that conversation, but we need to celebrate that, you know. The true heroes in this space, in my opinion, are those foot soldiers that go out day after day in any weather in hard, hard country and do that hard mahi. And we have so many amazing people like that, and we need to celebrate them, because if you remove enough of the bad stuff, the good stuff will take care of itself. And be fussy, not sporting. You know, be in it to win and take care around every trap set. Everything that you do as a predator hunter should be incredibly personal to you, because ultimately landscape scale predator control is one trap and one animal at a time. And you need to think big scale, but then you need to think very, very small as well. And make it so personal. You know, I say to trappers when I'm training them, turn your cell phone off. You know, I mean, have your messages in case you need to be contacted, but don't be listening to music while you're on your trap line. You should be focused on what you're doing. You're not there for a nature walk, although it's lovely to be in the bush. You are there to win, and you are there to do something really, really worthwhile.
No, thank you for saying that. I fully second that. Hey, those people are absolutely amazing and hat off, especially to those community groups that are mostly volunteer-based. They are, as you said, the heroes of the story. So,
One thing I'd say too is, and we see that a lot at Save the Kiwi. It's amazing. You know, Kiwi are the most amazing species. And I'll be really honest with you. Back when I first started working with Kiwi, I went, oh, yeah, Kiwi. You know, what is it about them? Why are they our national bird? And you know, well, I can still remember the first time I caught my own, caught a Kiwi. You know, I was with a handler and we pulled one out of a burrow and they asked me to hang on to it for them while they did a transmitter change. And I was under really good tuition because it's so important when you're handling Kiwi that it's done right by people who know what they're doing. But anyway, but it changed my life. And I was like, what is it about Kiwi? You know, well, I still can't answer that, but they are the most incredible bird. But the thing that Kiwi do is they capture hearts and minds of conservation people. And when people start a project and they start doing predator control for Kiwi or a number of other key iconic species, what happens is that the biodiversity in that region benefits from the effort that's being put in to grow a population of Kiwi. There are so many spin-off benefits from that. And one of the things I see with my work with Save the Kiwi is that we've got these amazing projects out there that we support, and it's not just Kiwi that are benefiting. It's so many other Tonga species around Kiwi as well. And that's a really, really neat flow-on effect. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. So doing good predator control, especially if it's focused on a species, does have these flow-on effects. And over time, they compound. So if we zoom forward 10 years or 50 years, what could success look like with good quality predator control that lasts?
Amazing is probably the only way to describe it. What really kick-started my conservation journey years ago was going into a valley after 2 or 3 years away and being blown away at the bird song in the morning in a valley that I was used to being largely silent. And it was a community group that had been doing a huge amount of possum, stoat and rat control while I'd been away. And so the difference when you do really good pest and predator control, the response can be quite quick with some species. And it's mind-boggling. So I think Wellington is a great example of what can be achieved over a large area by a whole heap of committed people in an urban environment. It's mind-boggling. There's just, like, I grew up for a period of my life in Wellington and all we heard at night were possum screeching. Now it's kaka. You know, and there's kiwi in backyards and hihi, and it's just amazing. So, you know, it will vary place by place, but we've been in a hold the line sort of a phase nationally, I think. And the last few years in particular, things have really started to snowball, and we're now starting to bring the Māori back to the forest. The life force is coming back, and the diversity is coming back. So there is no doubt in my mind that 10 to 20 years from now, if we keep this momentum and we keep learning, we keep adding new tools, and we keep that investment of time and money, that we're actually going to start to turn the tide back, not just hold the line. That's pretty neat.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess further forward, if we can turn that tide back, the future of our whenua, our ecosystems, our nahere is just, well, it's almost hard to fathom, and we might have forgotten what it was like 100 years ago or 50 years ago, but there's a possibility where we can get back to something like that one day.
100%. You know, I think those of us that work in this space, and there's so many of us now, I think we're lucky, because I think we're all going to sit on our rocking chair on our porch when we're 80 or 90 years old, be 120, that's my plan. But you know what, we're going to be able to sit on our porch in our old age and look back and be proud of the difference we made, you know, because it sounds really flowery to say this, but really ultimately everything in life comes back to family And did you leave the world a better place? And I think for us in conservation, particularly over the last 20, 30 years and moving forward rapidly, there's those of us that are very fortunate to be able to say we did our bit. And what an amazing thing to be able to say. You know, to think about an area that's full of life again, that was quiet when you started, and look back on that. You know, that's a pretty neat thing to think about. Yeah, pretty cool.
Yeah, it is pretty cool, and I 100% agree. And if, yeah, what a cool dream that would be. And I think all the three of us are going to work and continue to work very hard for that to come.
Oh, yeah.
True. So other than trapping, what practical tips would you like to share that people can do to help nature?
Have fun. Don't forget to have fun. You know, it's a bit like fitness and health. It should be a byproduct of something that you enjoy doing. If you have to go out and exercise because you feel you should, you won't end up doing it for long. And so with all of this predator control, I mean, for a lot of us, some of us, it's we're lucky enough that it's our job, but it should still be fun. And if it's fun and we enjoy it, then we look forward to it and we're going to do better at it and we're going to invest more of ourselves in it. So whether you're a full-time paid professional or a community trapper, make sure you're enjoying what you do. And that way it will be more sustainable long-term. One of the biggest challenges we have, I think, is that We need to make sure that we're looking after the people that are doing the hard yards so that they keep doing the hard yards. Because if we lose them, man, it's pretty hard to find people that will commit like that. So don't forget to have fun. And it's okay to have fun. You know, I think sometimes we take ourselves a little too seriously in this game. You know, I mean, I'm here to win. And anyone that knows me knows that I'm really competitive in this space, trap by trap, and I'm really fussy, but I still want to enjoy it. You know, I can't remember the last day I woke up and didn't want to go to work, you know, because I love what I do. And it's important to keep the fun and the enjoyment in what we do. That's probably the most important thing we could do, really. Otherwise, we'll just beat ourselves up.
Yeah. For sure. And when I think about getting up and doing stuff, and I look back on my life in both conservation and in my career and personal relationships, things have always ended when the fun's disappeared. As long as it's been fun, it's stayed in my life. Like, as soon as I've you know, felt a bit bad about doing something multiple times, I think, okay, it's time to end this. time to move on.
Yeah.
So definitely. And there's so much fun to be had out there in nature.
Yeah. And it's okay to celebrate your success. You don't need to shout it from the rooftops or post online or whatever, but occasionally at the end of the day, have a brew or whatever and go, yeah, right on, I did a good day. And too often, once again, in conservation, because we're up against it so much, I think sometimes we get a little bit down in the dumps or we get a bit serious, you know, and it's actually okay to have fun and to pat yourself on the back and go, yeah, I did all right. My reality is that I'm never happy with what I've done because there's always something else. And that's okay, but don't let it bury you. Strive for improvement, but celebrate your success probably would be my advice. And it's okay to do that. It's okay to celebrate your own success with yourself, and it's okay to win.
Yeah, I think that definitely is a recipe to success. Say, acknowledge, celebrate, and then improve and carry on. I definitely, I like working to that myself as well. And so speaking of conservation in the bigger picture, what does conservation mean to you, John?
Hey, Togana, people. It's all about the people. That for me is, you know, when I started in doing what I do, it was about catching more. And then it became about catching the uncatchable. And I love that. That's become my passion. I love nothing more than a hard adversary. But what's happened for me in recent years is my true passion now is actually the people I work with. It's been I've been honoured to be invited to work with Hapu and Iwi more and more as well at place. And that's been an incredible experience for me, very humbling experience. I sort of go there as the teacher and always come away feeling like the student, and I've been incredibly welcomed in that place. And so once again, it's all about the people. And, you know, we all come from different walks of life, whether you're a city-dwelling person protecting a small bush block on your back door, whether you're a farmer. Yeah, it's all people, and everyone's different, and every project's different. And it wins and loses, lives and breathes on the people.
Yep. Yeah, definitely. That's been a big growth in our, I think, perception of conservation since we started this podcast as well. So wrapping up, let's say someone wants to get in touch with you. How can they connect with you, and how can they support or engage your work?
Probably the easiest way is just email me, john@bbem.co.nz. You can go onto my website, Backblocks, and send me a message that way as well. And then I'm on Facebook under Backblocks or NZ Predator Hunter on Instagram. So, yeah, I never thought I'd be saying all these different ways of getting hold of me. I never thought I'd be that guy. I've always been very old school. But anyway, you've got to move with the times. But, yeah, email's a really good one for me.
Awesome. Yep. And if you're hanging out on social, John's Instagram is NZ Predator Hunter, has some really good insights as you learn and discover stuff and share it. I've been really enjoying it.
Thank you. It's been lots of fun, actually. Once again, it's about people, and yeah, I really enjoy being asked questions and helping people out if I can. It's a very positive industry to work in most of the time. People are great. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. And conservation is definitely a team sport. It takes all of us to join to be successful, isn't it?
100%. 100%. Yeah.
Thank you so much, John, for joining us today. I thoroughly enjoyed our chat. So, yeah, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and for your time.
Thank you. Yeah,
thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Oh, look, it's just so good to be talking. I love talking about this stuff. It's just, there's so much to discuss and there's so much to learn. Yeah, no, thank you. Well done on what you're doing too. I think it's fantastic. We need more of this.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, kia ora.
Yeah, kia ora.